we're going to sing our gathering song. Come, come, wherever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, doors is no caravan of despair. Come, yet again, come, come. Good morning and welcome. Whether this is your first time or 400th, you're welcome here. Unitarian Universalists strive to embrace and include all in a loving and caring community, at the same time as we try to create a world that is diverse, hospitable, joyous, and just. Whatever your story, wherever you come from, whoever you are, whoever you love, whatever your journey has been, it has led you here, and we are glad to have you. And for anyone new to the fellowship, we welcome you, and hopefully you've signed the visitor's log out front, and we look forward to talking with you after fellowship, where everyone is welcome to go to the Ina's Alsop room for coffee afterwards. There are announcements in your bulletin about the craft and bake sale coming up, and after Thanksgiving, soup lunch, so we welcome you to look at those. And our welcoming and hospitality following the morning service next Sunday. So Jake is going to help me light the chalice. Today's chalice lighting reading is an excerpt from, or an adaptation of, an invocation by Heather Januels, who's the associate minister at Cedar Lane UU in Bethesda, Maryland, and she gave this invocation at a UUA annual meeting. From the power of our memory and history, with high hopes for the days that lie ahead, we gather to craft the destiny we share with one another. We gather with faith in the practice of democracy. We gather with hearts and minds open to the wisdom in every voice among us. In our gathering, may we dream and design a bold future. May we imagine a new story that widens the circle. May we bring our best selves to this service. And may we dream those dreams and do this work with love. Excuse me. Now we will sing our first hymn, number 290, Bring, O Pasture, Honor.
Thank you.
The theme this month is stories and telling stories. And part of our stories are joys and sorrows. So now we invite you, if you have anything joyful or if you want to share a burden, please raise your hand and the mic. Someone will bring the mic.
I'm afraid I have a sorrow today. Thursday afternoon, my friend Larry was walking across the street in Topeka, and a truck came around the curve and hit him, and he's gone. So sorry to give you some bad news, but I'm like, I just saw him the other day. I'm like, Larry's gone, and like, but they hit him and he died like a couple hours later, I think. So, but sorry about that.
Well, it's perfect for this to be joys and sorrows, because this last year for me has been a roller coaster ride of up and down. But I'm ending on a wonderful up, and that is my son Joey is engaged to Samantha Sams. Yeah! Woohoo!
Colleen and Stu Stanton were grandparents as of Thursday. So, Ariana Ray.
For the joys and sorrows, spoken and unspoken, we keep those in our hearts. Now it is time for our anthem, Waiting for the Light to Shine.
Lest you miss it, this is a story. It's an updated version of Amazing Grace.
And now if the kids would join me for the story for all ages. Hi, how are you guys all doing?
Good.
Good. So this month, oh, hey, it's great. great to see you guys again. This month, we are talking about stories and telling our own stories. So this is a book about a girl who gets a special storybook. The Whisper. That's right. There once was a little girl who loved stories. She loved how the words and pictures took her to new and secret places that existed in a wonderful world all her own. The characters became her friends, and quite often she grew to love them. One afternoon, while waiting for school to be dismissed, the little girl noticed a mysterious book perched high up on a shelf. "What's that book?" she asked the teacher. "That is a magical book of stories," replied her teacher. "It was a gift from my grandmother when I was just about your age. I have an idea. Would you like to borrow it for the night?" "Oh, yes, please. Thank you," said the little girl, just as the clock struck 3. The teacher gave her the book, and with great anticipation, the little girl sprinted out the door and ran all the way home. Uh-oh. What's happening to the book as she's running home?
I know. The words are falling out.
The words are falling out. And who's this back here catching all the words? Is the fox catching the words? Once home, the little girl greeted her dog and ate supper, and when she was just about to burst with excitement, she escaped to her room to read. The little girl opened the book and began turning through the pages one by one. Each picture was more beautiful and curious. Yep, the fox is there. More curious than the next. By the time she arrived at the very last page, she could scarcely see, for her eyes were filled with tears. Yeah. Hey, Arthur, let's let the other kids learn the story for the first time, okay? But you can help them with pointing out what's in the story, okay? Where were the words? Where were the stories? It's just not a book of stories without any words, she thought. The words fell out. As the little girl paged through the wordless book, she heard the wind blow and then a small whisper. Who's doing the whispering? The fox. "Dear little girl, don't be disappointed. You can imagine the words. You can imagine the stories. Start with a few simple words and imagine from there. Remember, beginnings, middles, and ends of stories can always be changed and imagined differently. There are never any rules, rights, or wrongs in imagining. Imagining just is." The whisper sounded so knowing and wise to the little girl that she opened the book to the first page and began. So here's the picture she saw.
The two bears.
So she had to come up with a story. Yeah, and the bear, yep. The bunny and the fox are on every page. Yeah, let's see what story she comes up with for this picture. At first, it felt difficult to imagine a story, so she looked harder at the picture. Are the bears best friends? She wondered. Maybe the blue bear is bringing honey as a gift. Bears love honey. Yeah, Blue Bear's Visit. Now that's a good title, she thought. Then she began to tell herself a story. Blue Bear arrived on the first day of spring. He promised... ... The little girl studied the second picture. There's that little rabbit again, she thought. I wonder what that man is saying to the magnificent ox. I know the secret. Mr. Ox, you must please promise not to tell anyone, but we need your help. Last week... ... The words began to come more and more easily to the little girl. Then the words grew into sentences, and the sentences became stories. So here's the next picture.
The quest.
The quest. Their 100-mile journey began in a sturdy wooden boat. Are we there yet? Asked Rabbit. In another 2 days and one night, replied Lion. Oh, that's a very long time. I forgot. Please remind me again. Where are we going? Asked Rabbit. And then this title and story for this picture, Tiger's Prayer. All the creatures of the land, near and far, would be coming, and preparations were being made. The clown in the pointed hat would play music on his accordion. The wind horse would jump through hoops. Tea would be served exactly at noon, for Tiger had something important to say. ... And for this picture, A birthday party. As instructed, we arrived exactly at 333. 1 4-leaf clover and a large pot of hot, steeping tea had been purposely placed near the entrance of the woods. An owl perched in a tree to our left asked, Who? And we promptly answered with the secret password. Our job was to bring the birthday cake, vanilla with vanilla cream frosting and black raspberry filling with exactly 6 candles on top. Pan was very particular, and you could never quite know what to expect. But he insisted on throwing the surprise birthday party for... .. Yeah, he does look like you.
He is me.
Okay. And then here's a picture of some whales.
Turning into bubbles.
Or bubbles turning into whales. Who knows? We'll find out. What story did she come up with? The magical cloak. One night, a mysterious man in an elaborate cloak sailed into our harbor. Quite quickly, it became obvious to us that he was some kind of wizard or magician, for he could blow bubbles in the shapes of things. What was even more extraordinary was that the bubbles, once released, became real. Before long, enormous white whales filled our once calm harbor. Amazing as it was to see, we had to do something quickly, too. .. And on this picture, a golden key. That very morning, Owl told us he would pick us up at midnight. We must be on time and prepared for anything. He held the small golden key tightly in his beak as we flew into the indigo night. We were ready to face... .. Like that owl. And then on this, and word by word, hour after hour, the little girl imagined an entire story for each page. And when the moon was full and bright, she grew sleepy and drifted off into a dream world woven out of the threads of the pictures and the stories she had imagined. When she woke, the little girl felt grateful for the small, knowing whisper. Already, she missed her new friends, the ox, the owl, and the tiger. She yearned to open the book once again, but the sun was up over the horizon and the birds were already fluttering about, chirping their morning songs. She did not want to be late for school, so she tidied herself, scooped up the book, and rushed out the door. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Along the path, she met a fox holding a curiously round package. "Excuse me, little girl," said the fox. "I believe I have the words to your book. I saw them spill away, and because I am a very clever kind of fox, I caught them in my net just before they drifted too far off." "Oh, thank you," replied the little girl, feeling a bit confused. "Now, please, before you leave, could I bother you for a small favor?" asked the fox. "Why, of course," answered the little girl. The fox thanked the little girl, and the little girl thanked the fox, and she gathered the book and the bundle of words and hurried down the path toward school once again. "I am so sorry I am late," said the little girl, still catching her breath. "There was a whisper, and I imagined stories for every picture, and I overslept, and the words. I didn't know that they had fallen away, but the clever fox caught them in his net, and, but I loved your book, and I almost forgot. Thank you. I have so many stories to tell you." "I can't wait to hear," replied the teacher with a smile.
The end.
The end. Yeah, the fox and the grapes. A famished fox saw some clusters of ripe black grapes hanging from a vine. She resorted to all her tricks to get them. And then the rest of the paragraph is crossed out, and it's added, "But this fox is of the very clever kind, so she imagined her story differently. And the grapes tasted ever so sweet." The end. All right. Thank you. Now is the time when we can share our gifts with the fellowship and listen to beautiful music by Renee and her backup singers.
Don't worry. and sun. Three little birds perch on my doorstep, singing sweet songs of melodies pure and true, saying, "This is my message to you. Don't worry about a thing, 'cause every little thing's gonna be alright. Don't worry about a thing, 'cause every little thing's gonna be alright. Woke up this morning, smile at the rising sun. Three little birds perch on my doorstep, singing sweet songs, melodies pure and true, saying, this is my message to you. Singing, don't worry about every little thing's gonna be all right. Singing, don't worry about a thing, 'cause every little thing's gonna be all right.
For as long as I can remember, I've wanted to be a writer and a journalist. There were multiple other interests as well, but telling stories, either true or made up, was always on my list of things I wanted to be when I grew up. I'm fortunate that I've been able to have a career as a writer and a storyteller, and I've been able to tell different types of stories. At National Geographic, we provided a platform for people to share their stories, people who often don't get to tell their stories. So it felt nice to give voice to those who had previously been unheard. My job at National Geographic magazine was to ensure that the stories were fair and accurate. I had to look at a story from all different angles, not just two sides, all different angles, because every story has at least two sides, but most have more. And those sides also have nuance. So I had to uncover all aspects of the story and make sure that the one we were presenting to the public was the most accurate and fair version, which didn't always mean balanced, and there was often not a clear good guy or a bad guy. When covering controversial topics, I felt I had done my job well when I received an equal amount of hate mail from all different sides. Now I work at the KSU Foundation as what my boss calls the chief storyteller of the foundation and K-State. My job is to shape the story of how philanthropy positively impacts K-State. In this role, my job is to not tell a well-rounded story with all angles covered. Instead, my job is to invoke a feeling of pride in K-State and a desire to want to give it money. It's a completely different type of storytelling. It's more PR and marketing than journalism. So we are all storytellers, telling the story of ourselves to others the way we want to be perceived. Stories connect us and sometimes divide us. Listening, really listening to each other's stories could bring more understanding, which I think is the true power of storytelling. Thank you. Now we will sing our hymn number 404, What Gift Can We Bring?
Thank you. The short and simple answer to what does it mean to be a community of story is it means we are human. It can be tough to make accurate generalizations about human beings. We're so culturally and personally diverse. Our experiences, values, and expectations diverge so widely and so surprisingly. But on this question of story, we are in profound agreement. Human beings like stories. Since earliest times and in all societies, we've sat around fires and woven tales, lowered the lights to watch performances, live and filmed, sat around the dining table or stove and recounted the family lore. We read stories to children when we tuck them in at night and base our religious traditions on mythic narratives. People sing stories in ballads and opera and dance them in ballet and hula. Stories pervade the human imagination. Chinese shadow puppets, West African griots, East Indian temple dancers, all around the world, various forms and traditions have grown up to tell stories. Human brains prefer stories to cold, hard facts. They're easier to remember. Literary voice Reynolds Price wrote, "A need to tell and hear stories is essential to the species Homo sapiens. Second in necessity, apparently, after nourishment and before love and shelter. Millions survive without love or home, almost none in silence. The opposite of silence leads quickly to narrative, and the sound of story is the dominant sound of our lives, from the small accounts of our day's events to the vast incommunicable constructs of psychopaths." Did you have a particular story that shaped you through childhood? Maybe Star Wars or Lord of the Rings, Nancy Drew or Sweet Valley High, The Wizard of Oz or Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Let me hear a few. What are the stories that struck you deeply in childhood?
Star Trek.
Star Trek. Hmm?
The Hobbit.
The Hobbit.
Peter Pan.
Peter Pan. Oh, I'm hearing too many at once and they blend in. What did you say?
Lion King.
Velveteen Rabbit.
She-Ra.
Wind in the Willows.
Robin Hood.
Goldilocks.
Pooh Bear.
Snarler.
There are a lot of them. They just go on and on. These stories, they're more than a way to fill time and entertain.
Eeyore.
Our, the stories, they teach us morals and manners, and through story we extract ways of living. They help us understand how life works. Stories open our imagination so that we can identify with people we might otherwise see as strange or enter into situations that are different for our own lives so that they would, ways that would be unrelatable if we didn't have the story. And some of them stand out for me. In elementary school, I remember reading a book about an African-American girl entering a world I'd seen only from a distance. I read biographies of famous women, Hatshepsut in Egypt, Queen Lililokalani in Hawaii, and entered those worlds. Research shows that people actually who read more fiction develop more empathy, even when controlling for the possibility that empathetic people may be more drawn to fiction. But political theorist Hannah Arendt suggested that storytelling makes private meaning into public meaning. When we share our story, others join with us and often find themselves in our story. When we join together as individual people in an organization like a congregation, our stories merge and meld too, creating a public persona, and we'll consider more about that next week. When I worked in community organizing, we had a formula for a public meeting with the core being 3 to 5 people,
real people telling real stories from their lives that illustrated an issue of concern. And though these were only like 2-minute snippets, they drew the audience in and gave them inspiration and direction in ways that statistics or political analysis never could have. Stories give us meaning and direction. Stories provide multiple layers. The characters give us people to identify with or to judge. The settings invite us into unfamiliar times and places, exciting curiosity and asking us to suspend our expectations. Symbolism often plays a role in stories. So a road may be about life, a bird about freedom, a color about emotion. Many stories that are our favorites are not true stories, but fiction. Yet somehow they express a deeper truth, a truth that is about ideas and meaning rather than facts and figures. Not literal truth, but metaphorical truth. The best stories have so many levels that when you return to them, they blossom with new meaning. A story that deeply shaped me in my youth was the story of Queen Esther, a bit of an obscure book in the Hebrew Bible, though for Jews it provides the underpinning of the holiday Purim, which is a raucous festival of costumes and drinking. So Esther is an interesting biblical book because it doesn't include the word God. For that reason, Martin Luther thought it should be removed from the canon. And besides, it probably never happened, but as I said a moment ago, that doesn't mean that it doesn't express great truths. The gist of the story is that Esther, a good Jewish girl, ends up becoming queen of Persia by winning a beauty pageant. Except no one knows she's a Jew, even her husband, King Ahasuerus. Meanwhile, Haman, one of the king's advisors, is plotting to kill all the Jews. What is Esther to do? Stay in hiding about who she is for safety's sake? Plead for her people by admitting that she's Jewish and thereby risk her own life? Her cousin Mordecai, who has raised her from childhood, urges her to action. Who knows, he says, perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this. The words, for such a time as this, echo forcefully. The phrase has become a contemporary Christian ballad and is used across the theological spectrum as a reference to call to ministry. And the climax of the story comes as Esther walks into the court without permission. And in doing so, she risks death because people who haven't been invited into the court can be killed. And the queen before her had been banished for far less a violation. So after fasting and preparation, she walks into the court, and King Ahasuerus extends his scepter, welcoming her. And reading this text as a preteen moved me. I knew little about how to read scriptures except to sink into the story. I did know the feeling of fear that I imagined Esther must have felt. I knew fear of the dark, fear of heights, fear of dogs, fear of disappointing those I loved, and had already worked strenuously to overcome such fears. And I'd learned to recognize injustice. I had seen homeless people sleeping on the streets of Washington, D.C. I'd encountered bullying in school and witnessed racial inequality. I realized that I needed courage to counter fears about confronting injustice, just as I had conquered climbing trees and petting dogs. But I wasn't quite sure how to muster it. But Esther gave me an example. She faced a controlling man who had the power of life and death, and she broke a rule to come into the court, and she won. There's more plot to unfold in the story, but once Ahasuerus extends the scepter and accepts her presence and also offers her up to half his kingdom, her cause is won. Spoiler alert, Haman ends up dying on the gallows and the Jews are saved. For me, that moment, the pause before entering the court, became a touchstone through my early decades.
When I had to enter the principal's office to answer to the politically charged message in the introduction to the yearbook I edited, when I addressed a legislative committee investigating conditions at the residential school where I worked, when I sat in the courtroom in support of a teacher fired for her sexual orientation, when I spoke out, as I learned to over the years, for the dispossessed and for myself, in these times I called on the image and courage of Esther. Some of you have seen the white robe I have. One of the reasons that I bought that robe is that the style is called Esther. So my fast was stepping into her shoes to equip myself to make that walk into the court. I lived into the story to awaken my own courage to set aside my own fears. If Esther could do it, so could I. So story can inspire us. We also create our own stories of ourselves. All of us have stories to tell over that we tell over and over about our lives. The story of how we met our spouse, of how we chose our career, of the birth of our child, of the death of our parent. We tell our stories to reinforce our experience and so that we can understand better what has happened to us. This is true for trauma as well as joy, failure as well as success. It's why we tell stories of those we love after they die. We are inscribing those stories on our hearts and minds so that our loved one lives on. We really only learn from our experience when we have translated and refined what we have learned through story. Without putting it into a form, it's hard to learn from experience. We need the story to make meaning out of our lives. And we do the same thing on a communal level. Our families have stories. Our congregation does. Our nation does. We tell origin stories. Some of them may be history, but it's useful to think of them as story. The Pilgrims, the War for Independence, the Great Depression, the post-war boom, 9/11. None of these stories is singular. They are collections of individual stories, and they always have a particular perspective. As consequential, powerful, and unavoidable as stories are, they can also mislead us, even trap us in a lie. The American Dream is one of those stories that has left many people sorely disappointed when it has not come true as they expected. The Cinderella story has not always worked out, whether for a team looking for a championship or a young woman looking for a prince. Happily ever after rarely is in real life. Even if the Cubs did overcome their century-long story of themselves as losers. Because we make sense of things through story, people can use story to manipulate. Television commercials tell a short little story with the problem solved by the product advertisers want to sell. At trial, attorneys may spin a narrative and hang the facts onto the skeleton of a story so that their version looks more likely than the rival's story. It may not have happened exactly that way, but by arranging the facts, they point to a satisfying story. Political campaigns construct stories to entice voters to their version of reality, the story of their candidate, or the story of the nation that they want us to participate in by our vote. We may be suspicious of that kind of storytelling, but stories are so seductive, especially when we hear them very young. We can see them as a map of the world that tells us how to live our lives. And that's why feminists were so upset by many of the stories that filled my youth, the Cinderellas and Snow Whites, where women were the central characters, but their fulfillment and success required getting a husband who was a prince. We've altered that some with new heroines like Anna and Elsa and Frozen and Merida from Brave, but not all is well in fantasy land. Today, the whiteness of the Oscars the last couple of years has led us to a recognition that stories, as told by Hollywood, promote a skewed world. Only about a third of speaking roles in movies are women, though women make up a bit over half the population. It's similarly bleak for people of color, who had 28.3% of speaking roles, though they represent 40% of the population. When the most visible stories in our culture present primarily a particular perspective, a white male, and I might add straight and rich perspective, we are being shaped to believe a false picture of the world. Oh, it's just stories, one might say. We know movies are fiction, but are we really so good at distinguishing reality from fantasy? Can we even do it in our own lives? Scientists used to believe that when we brought up memories from long-term memory and went over them again, we didn't change the original memory. Turns out, whenever we revisit a long-term memory, we re-encode it. Our brains then, as we remember and retell, literally recreate our stories. Have you ever been with siblings and told childhood stories only to find out that you all remember it differently? That's an example of how we've reconstructed facts. And you could consider that problematic if our memory was like a video recording that we could trust to be objective. But it's not. Our memories include our emotional responses as well as sensory data, our judgments as well as our observations, which is another reason our sibs don't agree with our memories of that Thanksgiving years ago. They had different feelings and judgments. The advantage to the way that we encode long-term memory is that we can rewrite our stories, either to include new information that we didn't know before, or to look at our lives from a different perspective. Psychologists call it narrative therapy, a process of telling a story that grounds a particular problem, then finding new ways of seeing that story and retelling it so that the problem is minimized. Now, here's a simple example from UU minister Amanda Pompei. She writes, "I used to believe a story that I was a bad driver. I don't like driving on highways. I once hit a parking post in a garage. I needed the examiner to explain a three-point turn during my driver's test." All those things are true, and so the story must be true, too. But over time, I've worked on hearing a different story about how I drive all through D.C., handling traffic circles like a pro. The story's about good parallel parking skills and always wearing my seatbelt and using my blinker. It's about passing my driver's test the first time, since I did, after all, know how to do a three-point turn. Those things are all true, too. So the story must be true. So the stories that we tell ourselves are interpretive, at least as much as reality-based. We have some freedom to choose our stories, not absolute freedom. If your stories drift far enough away from other facts that other people agree on, they become psychotic fantasies. But since we have stashed emotional and interpretive content in with our objective and sense-based data, we can pull the whole mess out and pull apart what's there and ask ourselves, is what I believe to be true about myself, about my life, really based in truth? Or have I distorted it? Do I need a new story? So we begin with, are there ways that my stories about myself have limited me? Does being daddy's little girl keep me from challenging male authority? Does the story that I'm a klutz keep me from trying to ski or dance or something else I might actually enjoy? Have I set aside my real desires to try to duplicate the life I thought was happy in childhood?
These questions are difficult because our stories permeate our lives in ways that we are not even conscious of. Part of the challenge is that when new facts we encounter don't fit into our story, we tend to ignore the facts rather than reconfigure our story. I read an editorial recently that talked about the limits of story when applied to the electoral process. If the story is about a competition, a race, where one people wins everything and others are left behind, then all the information is sifted through the question, who is going to win? The debate coverage becomes who won, instead of what policies did each candidate propose, or what did we learn about each candidate? When the story is the race, then polls are more important than any other facts. Ezra Klein observed that the media isn't really biased toward a particular candidate, but instead toward a particular story, the tale of a race. And the same thing happens with our cultural stories. We have unhealthy cultural stories that we tell about ourselves. Manifest Destiny is one such story. How white Americans were given this continent to expand into, to conquer, to exploit. We provide pillars for the story with characters like Daniel Boone and Lewis and Clark and plot lines from every Western you've ever seen. In the meantime, like in the Hollywood movies, people of color and even women receive short shrift. We dismiss non-aggressive approaches to problems, and our expectations of what a nation is are skewed. You can demonstrate the same point with crime dramas and mysteries. In the formula, there are victims, there are bad guys, and there's some hero who pursues and ultimately finds the bad guys and either arrests or kills them. And that limits our options. What if our stories had more transformative endings? Endings with repentance and reconciliation. Might we begin to imagine ways to reconstruct our story about crime and punishment? Might there be alternatives that we could live into? Stories have such incredible power for good and for ill. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, a Nigerian novelist, has done a moving TED Talk about the danger of a single story. It's something you might want to look up. She grew up middle class in Lagos, and her family had a servant who her mother insisted on telling her was poor. She was quite surprised then to discover that his family made beautiful baskets. She had reduced him to a single characteristic and not a complete person. Similarly, Adichie's college roommate in America had only a single story about Africa. She was surprised that Adichie listened to Mariah Carey and knew how to use a stove. Authentic Africans apparently are poor, hungry, and tribal and only know music from their own continent. None of us is one thing. None of us has a single story. Our nation certainly doesn't have a single story. Stories are shaped by who has the power to tell them, by the perspectives that they include and exclude, by the visions they cast and the boundaries they draw. And stories shape us, which means we need to continually examine our stories for truth, for completeness, and for how they serve or disserve us. Stories can break and stories can repair, said Chimamanda Adichie. Indeed, stories can break and stories can repair. I close my remarks with this poem by Liesel Mueller. After the poem, let's take a brief silence, and then welcome discussion. Why we tell stories, for Linda Foster. One, because we used to have leaves, and on damp days our muscles feel a tug. painful now from when roots pulled us into the ground. And because our children believe they can fly, an instinct retained from when the bones in our arms were shaped like zithers and broke neatly under their feathers. And because before we had lungs, we knew how far it was to the bottom as we floated, open-eyed like painted scarves through the scenery of dreams, and because we awakened and learned to speak. Two, we sat by the fire in our caves. And because we were poor, we made up a tale about a treasure mountain that would open only for us. And because we were always defeated, we invented impossible riddles only we could solve, monsters only we could kill, women who could love no one else. And because we had survived sisters and brothers, daughters and sons, we discovered bones that rose from the dark earth and sang as white birds in the trees. Three, because the story of our life becomes our life. Because each of us tells the same story, but tells it differently. And none of us tells it the same way twice. Because grandmothers looking like spiders want to enchant the children, and grandfathers need to convince us that what happened happened because of them. And though we listen only haphazardly, with one ear, we will begin our story with the word "and." So if you have a question or comment, raise your hand and Jessica will bring a mic to you.
And one time when Michaela was a baby, she got dropped on her head. I've retold this story many times. He had nothing to do with it. I was there. I've added the comment that if we didn't, then she'd be way too smart. But it occurred to me the other day that maybe she doesn't like this story. Because we tell it all the time. You know, you get the eye roll and the groan. But I think it's also important that when you're telling stories about other people, you should make sure that it's not causing injury to them. The story may have hurt them, but at the time, she had this little bump on her head, and she had an open fontanel still because she was little. So this goose egg, push on it, and it would pop up here. Anyway, the thought occurred to me yesterday while we were talking about this. I was like, do you mind when we share that story? She said no, so. Anyway, I thought I'd start us off with that.
Okay, since we're telling stories, and let me tell you about my Uncle Buddy. When I was a kid, he used to say he had Batman tied up in the back of his pickup truck. And we'd be like going, where's Robin? He's like, oh, he's running around somewhere. And then we'd go look in the back of a pickup truck and say, Uncle Buddy, Batman's not there. Oh, he got loose. And then we watched Super Friends. It's like, there's Batman. He's like, oh, yeah, he got loose. So I thought I'd tell you a story about my Uncle Buddy. He used to tell us every day that he had Batman tied up in the back of his pickup truck.
There is something about stories that are rituals, that they're rituals in our lives, and they're touchstones and important pieces. So it is true, especially in families. We tell those same stories over and over again. And part of it is to remind ourselves that we're family. This is our story. This is about Michaela or Uncle Buddy or... This is our story, yeah.
So one of the sets of stories that I really enjoy are stories that we tell in the morning when we wake up, our dreams. Mm. And my father was a vivid dreamer, and breakfast table almost always featured a story of or more of his dreams. One morning, we asked my little brother, did you have a dream last night? And he said, no, it was black all night. And that's a story we tell in our family.
Thank you, John and Lou. This was really interesting. My name is Kathy Hedge, and I was thinking this whole time with story, one of the things that's so great is this idea of the constantly reinventing or creating the stories. And I was sitting here thinking, you know, really the most power I feel in my entire life is when I'm sitting down and I'm writing a story and I know that nobody in the world has ever heard this story because I'm making it up right now. And it's really a fantastic feeling. Whether or not anybody ever reads the story, I know that I did it and I can read the story and be excited about it. So I think there's a really deep need somewhere in us to mm-hmm. tell and create and share stories.
Mm-hmm. My son is very fond of hearing stories about his dad and me and how we met. And it's interesting as we tell him these things, how they become some of his favorite stories. The stories of Otis, his dad, and his best friend, AJ, and the time when AJ's truck got wrapped around a train and such. It's funny because he had never met Otis's best friend and finally got to meet him. I know you. Is your truck still okay from the train? But it struck me as I was listening just how much, you know, these stories would not make very much sense to outsiders, really, and aren't very, very deep and meaningful, but to a family, it's like you have your own little collection of tales that comfort you, that tell me, Mom, tell me the story of this before I go to bed, before I go to sleep. Mm-hmm. Tuck me in with stories of you and us and how I came to be.
I see my husband had his arm up, too, and I don't know if that means he wants to tell the same story. Linda Johnson and Roger Johnson. Our daughter chose her career because of a story. When she was in sixth grade, she had an English teacher who made a habit of giving a book to each of his students as they were graduating from elementary school, sixth grade, going on to, in our area, was junior high. And the book that this man gave to Sarah was To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh.
She is now an appellate public defender working in the death penalty unit in Topeka. Did you have a story?
No. For my parents' 60th anniversary, my brothers and I planned a very elaborate all-day event. And members of the family arrived. They lived outside Phoenix at the time. And it was many hours of meeting. We had lunch and they had a little dance. My parents told their story of how they met at a dance when they were in college. But what I remember from that day was the evening when the family met around their patio and my mother's twin brother told the stories about how my father and mother were dating. And we, in my generation, had never heard those stories before. And so whenever we get together, we talk about the stories we heard around the patio in the back of their house. It was not part of our planning at all. Uh-huh. It was the unanticipated that made it so special.
Diane Barker, I might have told you all this story before, but it's one of my favorites. It's a coyote trickster story, and it's called Why Dogs Sniff. One day, the dog people were catching fish and drying them by the river. And they got up the next morning, all the fish were gone. So they began looking around and suspecting one another. And they said, "I know what we'll do. We'll sniff. Then we'll know who ate salmon, and we'll catch our thief." Well, they never caught the thief, but they're still looking.
In Cowan, thinking about how stories are repeated over and over again, my father-in-law was a great storyteller, and at his funeral, people started telling stories, and it took only one sentence before the whole group started laughing because everyone knew the story, and the next person would start a story, and they would say one sentence, and then everybody would laugh at the ending without it being told.
Mm-hmm. They become rituals. They become patterns, yeah.
We just had a family gathering last Sunday, and my daughter, while we were working in the kitchen, she suddenly said, "My wrist hurts." And so I started telling her the story of how she had hurt her wrist when she was about 2 years old, and thinking maybe that would help her find out why it hurt. And all at once I realized that everybody in the room had become completely silent, and they were listening to this story. And it just makes me realize how important it is to pass that story information about our earlier lives on to the younger generation.
This is a new story. Last night, Shirley asked me, "Shall we have dogs for dinner?" I said, "Woof." Gene Severs. Listening to John Alou, I realize there's this one young lady that influenced pretty much the total of my life after the age of 17. Because I was graduated from high school and I'd done well in math, so I was headed to K-State on an electrical engineering scholarship. And Gaynell Gassert asked what dorm I was staying in, and I said Marla Hatt, because that was the unofficial engineer dorm. And she said, "I think you should switch to Van Zyl," which was in the second year of co-ed status, which was still controversial. But it was effectively the unofficial honors dorm, which I won't claim that fit, but I will claim that with about a third of the students being cowboys and a third being nerds or geeks and a third being hippies, that I'm guilty of some of all of that. But just living in Van Zyl and former wife, friends, activities, AA, volleyball competition, my life is pretty much formed by that one decision, and I think in a good way.
Well, when Margene spoke, it reminded me that we have a story in common because we have a person in common. When my girls were little, we were at Britt's Farm Market one day buying produce of one sort or another, and there was a family there of little boys and girls that were the sons and daughters of the manager of the place. I think I have that right. And while we were there, these little children were chasing a snake. And one of them cut the head off the snake, and a little frog walked out of the body of the snake. It was going to be its meal. And the children saved it. So that was that's one of our family stories. Well, many years later, when I was teaching, one of my colleagues was Jim Armendaris, who is Margene's son-in-law. And it turns out that one of his family stories is of when he and his brothers and sisters were living at Britt's Farm Market. They were out in the yard one day chasing a snake that had consumed a frog, and one of them cut the head off of the frog, of the snake, and the little frog walked out. So my friend Jim Armendariz and I had a similar family story that we told over and over again.
We're connected by our stories. Our stories connect us.
Michael Oldfather, about a kindergarten teacher, a friend of mine, and one of the little boys, one of a twin set, said, I would like to know when there was no people in the world and one growed. And she said, well, you should ask your parents about this. And the next day, I asked my parents and they didn't know. So she told him the Genesis story and then she told him the evolution story. I don't believe either one of them.
I think we're probably down to one comment.
I don't know if this is a good one to end on, but I just wanted to say that I've always been curious why there's been family that I haven't been close to and relationships that haven't always gone well, but I find that I still tell their stories, and I always thought that was weird. And I think now that we've been talking about this, the reason for that is that and is very important. Like, there's a sense of context that's part of my story now from being around the other person. So,
yeah, we're connected by our stories. Sorry to leave some of those things hanging, but the conversation continues, doesn't it? And our closing hymn is number 300, With Heart and Mind, Please Rise in Body or Spirit. Story is yours. Craft it as you must, rewrite it when it's needed, live into it, not just as an actor, but as writer, director, and producer. Go and listen for the stories of others and find what you can of truth in their stories and in your own. So may it be.